Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the investigation of consciousness and the evolution of that consciousness and where we're going as a planetary civilization. That's how I like to think about it. And tonight's guest is someone who's going to be featured at Contact in the Desert coming up the end of May in Joshua Tree, California. That is May 29th to June 1st. So you can check out Contact in the Desert. I'll be talking tonight to Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a popular guest on Coast to Coast and hopefully a popular guest here. Hi, Rosemary.
Hey, Alan.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Of course. I think your work is really valuable because you tap into so many fields, fairies, angels, demons, djinns, paranormal, and then there's this whole ET element, and there's this higher consciousness, and you're also, well, you're a researcher. But what I'd like to talk about is how do we create a cosmology that includes all of this, the ETs and the these other realms and the paranormal. We live in one universe. We're not aware of these other levels, but have you developed a cosmology for all of it, or is it still sort of fragmented for you?
It's a work in progress, definitely, but it's really been the focus of my research for a good number of years. I started working full-time as an author and researcher investigator in 1983, and that was the beginning of my professional pursuit of lifelong interests, going way back to when I was a kid. And it always was apparent to me from the very beginning that all of these things are interconnected. They overlap. And the deeper I went into research in various fields, I could see that overlapping. And
That's what's so interesting. It does overlap, yes.
Well, it does. So the question is, how do we unify it? How do we bring it together? When clearly human beings have been having experiences with beings in other realms who share this planet with us, as well as beings from elsewhere. We've been having pretty much the same kinds of experiences throughout history, and yet we have fragmented them with different labels, with different cultural perspectives, religious perspectives, and yet there are common elements to them all. So one of the things that I look at in my research is where these common ground areas are in different fields, and try to find sort of a unifying definition or theme or explanation for them that can help us assimilate these experiences and advance consciousness. And that's really where things are going, Alan, because our experiences are changing our consciousness and vice versa. It's definitely one changes the other. And at some point in the future, maybe even not the very far future, considering how global we are in consciousness now, we are going to have a very expanded perception of reality. We are going to have a different reality that's going to incorporate all of these other entities and emerge.
Well, that's what I'm interested. What does that cosmology look like? And you've been probably on top of it as much as anyone out there, because not only are you a researcher, you're an experiencer. So a lot of, from what I know of you, it's based on personal witnessing. And so tell me what you think it all looks like.
I believe that many beings share this planet with us, and that most of our experiences are interdimensional, including beings we call extraterrestrials. I don't rule out visitors from other planets, off-world. But I do think that most of these beings that we're calling extraterrestrials really are interdimensionals, and that all of our other experiences, or at least most of them, have come from these other realities tied to the Earth as well. And as our consciousness expands and changes and we have more experiences, the boundaries between these other dimensions are going to become more permeable, maybe even start disappearing altogether. so that the Earth of the future, if we manage to survive on it, will be populated with not just human beings of different races and cultures, but these other entities as well. We'll be elbow to elbow, neighbor to neighbor, with beings who have the capability of interacting with us in this new reality. And that, I think, the pace of that happening is dependent upon our ability to keep pulling ourselves up to a higher spiritual perspective, as well as the impact of the Internet and global media. You know, we can have global mind fairly quickly now due to the Internet and instant media, and that's having a profound effect on our ability to literally shape reality. Most of us aren't even aware of this power. We react to global mind and global consciousness, but very few of us have explored ways to participate in it especially from a positive perspective.
Well, yes, but you know, it's sort of our origins. I just spent time with the Aborigines, and they don't have the same separation between the dimensions. Let's say they see women giving birth to spirit children, and they see these energies. And you know, even the Kogi, who were living in the high mountains of Colombia, came down and said, you know, you better start cleaning things up here because you're really disturbing our meditations. And you know, I'm just saying, yes, we're approaching it from two possibilities: this great global consciousness that's being brought through with the internet, and the fact that we can return to the indigenous wisdom that we all have. You know what I mean? There.
Oh, so yes, and so we've got a new emergent consciousness that's going to be incorporating ancient perspectives and ancient wisdom, along with, I guess, what you would call new consciousness or even new science. And it's very important to have the perspective of experiencer as well. And this is something that science kind of frowns on, that you can't seem to be a legitimate researcher of phenomena if you're an experiencer of it. But yet when it comes to these areas of alternate realities, you really can't fully understand them unless you experience them. And that's one of the things that has really been very important in the evolution of my research, that my research has enabled me to have experiences, and the experiences then deepen the research.
Well, doesn't that go along with the new model for science, in the sense that there's no objective reality, that only the quantum physics idea that reality is based on the subjective experience? So even people who seem to be objective researchers are still taking their mindset and their paradigm of experience to look at a set of experiments. So they're participating in a way that they're unconscious to, but it's the same thing that they say experiencers are doing. Their experiences of a different reality that they're bringing into the experiment. You know what I mean?
Well, yes, and even though we have the quantum perspective on, you know, there really is no such thing as being separate from what you're observing or you know, seeing, that you are participating in everything, and that changes then what you are participating in. Science still takes a very dim view of paranormal topics and ufology research. They're considered to be fringe areas, and people who have experiences are almost automatically ridiculed in the media and debunked. We haven't arrived at a point where our institutions enable us to have even objective analyses of experiences, and this puts experiencers at a considerable disadvantage to be automatically debunked from the get-go as someone who's having fantasies, or they've been mistaken. when in fact they're not. And, you know, we hear over and over again from experiencers, I know what I saw, I know what I experienced. And this was, when you document these things throughout history, human beings have had these same experiences. There is this fundamental reality to alternate realities that we've had from the get-go, and yet we have institutions that officially won't recognize that.
Well, yeah, because they want people to think a certain way, and if you think outside those institutional frameworks, it's unacceptable because, you know, there are people, well, you know, it's the same old story. People are threatened, the institutions are threatened if you think that your reality is different than what the accepted reality is. But they're just going to have to face it, because I think ufology, the study of UFOs and the study that you're doing with your investigation, it's a science. It may be a different type of science, but, you know, talk about that box that you have where you can pick up voices and sounds from other dimensions. I mean, there's a science to that, right?
Well, there's certainly some very sound research in that area. And in fact, I was just in Toronto over the weekend at Richard Syrett's Follow the Truth event. I was presenting on the evidence for the afterlife via technology and its ability to capture voice and also visual evidence to support the idea that we do survive death and that there is an afterlife and it can be photographed and described. And yet all the researchers for the last 100-150 years who have come up with incredible evidence that's very difficult to refute fall into this same targeting of ridicule and debunking that researchers in other fields experience. And yet this is one of the biggest questions that human beings have been concerned with throughout all time, is do we survive death, and if so, what is it like, and can we get some proof or evidence of it? And no matter what researchers come up with, it's against the interests of organized religion, because what if the evidence refutes what religion teaches? It's against the interests of state, because if you have religion in chaos because of proof of the afterlife, then you have some very large social unrest and unpredictable factors. It's against the interests of science, because science has no way of validating these things as of yet. And even the general public often turns kind of a blind eye and a deaf ear. It's like, well, we'd like to know, but we don't really want to know, because then it might upset our apple cart. And yet we're hurtling en masse toward significant changes in reality because of these avenues of research and because of our increasing personal experiences. So that, you know, the researchers in most of these fields, they're left to carry on their own at their own expense. Many talented scientists and engineers and academic professionals have to do it on their own, or they have to wait until they retire so they're not literally ostracized by their peers. You know, what's the matter with our system here that we can't incorporate these elements into some sort of, you know, structure of society?
Well, talk about some of those new experiments. Who's doing it, and what have they shown? I mean, you can talk to this audience about it. We're not going to disagree with what it's
well, certainly.
Finding.
But well, tell for me, example,
I'm interested. Yeah.
There's been quite a bit with voice communication, and it really goes back even to the days of the telegraph. As soon as we have had high technology for capturing and recording voice, and also then photograph as well, we've had unexplained phenomena. We've had anomalous voices, anomalous images that have spontaneously appeared. And that's galvanized many researchers then to go out and deliberately try and capture that. Well, from the early days of the Morse code, telegraph operators would get strange unknown messages. There have been strange voices coming over radio broadcasts from the earliest days. Marconi experienced them, and he thought they were beings on Mars communicating with us. That was his conclusion, and for that he was ridiculed in the media. Tesla got communication that he thought was from intelligent sources out in the universe. Edison was at least interested in capturing evidence of the afterlife. There's been quite a bit of controversy as to whether or not he actually developed a device, and I don't think he did. I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories about that. He certainly talked about it and about how it might be possible. And from then on, you know, with magnetic recording media, researchers discovered, usually accidentally at first, that mystery voices appeared on recordings of other things. And if they attempted to address those mystery voices directly, then they started having genuine communication with personalities that identified themselves. And so from about the 1950s on, even into the 80s, we've had researchers over the world who really set out to debunk these things and wound up being converts because of the evidence they accumulated. Friedrich Jurgensen, Konstantin Raudive, Sarah Estep, just to name several of the luminaries in this field. And so the trickle-down for that has occurred in paranormal investigation with adaptations of technology developed to capture mystery voices. It's now in devices used for paranormal investigation called Frank's boxes, ghost boxes, and, you know, other kinds of devices that will capture two-way communication. And so we have passive mystery voices, electronic voice phenomena, and that's where you put out a recording device and ask questions, leave space for answers, and see what kind of responses you get on playback. And then you have some of these other devices that deliver two-way real-time communication where you hear and get a direct answer to questions. Well, I've been experimenting with various of these devices since 2006, and I have accumulated quite a few clips of conversations that I cannot explain naturally. And it is still very controversial. There are many scientists who attempt to debunk these things, and a lot of controversy over how hard it is to understand the answers, and studies done that both support and refute the evidence.
Is there a consistency in the messages that have come back from the other side? I mean, do you find, has there been books about this? Have there been, you know, of course there's channeling and, you know, people have near death, but these voices, what do you find that's common among these voices?
It depends on the purpose that you're seeking contact with. For example, in paranormal investigation, an investigator is going to take some of these devices into an environment that's considered to be active. And questions might be, you know, identify yourself, who's here and why are you here, and do you know any of the people in the room? And the answers are usually typically fairly short. Then there are people who try and communicate with specific personalities, especially family and friends who've passed on to the other side. And there are people who say they can recognize the voices of people they know who've died. There have been forensics analyses done on voices to match the imprint of the EVP with recordings of that person when they were alive. And it's also been done with photographs that have been captured of people from the afterlife.
And it does
and
match.
Some astounding results.
The voices do match up, you're saying.
In many of these forensic studies, there's a laboratory in Italy that has been doing that using forensics that have been used in, for example, crime and voice prints, you know, to match up voice prints. And they found some incredible matches that the odds against it not being the same person would be in the hundreds of millions to one. And even so, science still does not consider that to be proof. It winds up being in a pile of data that's referred to as evidence in support of something. It supports it, but it doesn't prove it. And, of course, one of the problems that we face in dealing with these other realities is getting controlled studies, consistent results, you know, replication. There seem to be so many variables to the conditions under which these contact elements take place that it's literally impossible to control them. And so that presents a problem for science as well.
Well, it's obvious because, I mean, I know what you're saying is true. I had my own experience with a ghost. Actually, I was sleeping in a haunted house. This something was waking me up in the middle of the night. And then at some point, I think it was in a dream state, I felt like I threw this person out of the house, and then I was able to sleep, you know, after this disturbance was gone. I mean, I don't know. Have you ever heard of anything like that happening in your research?
Our dreams are one of the most common mediums that we have encounters in. And
right.
It's hard to say if that would fall under what I would call a normal dream that was just intensely lucid or realistic, or some sort of actual paranormal encounter. If it's a paranormal encounter, it's likely to you might have the same kind of experience again.
It felt paranormal more than a dream, but it was a lot of these experiences. I mean, even in fairy circles or these djinn type, you're in a different state of consciousness. There's even ET contact. There's a shift in awareness that goes along with a lot of these encounters. Do you find that to be true? I mean, that's what I think.
Yes, Alan, I do, across the board, regardless of whether people are initially awake or whether they're shifted in their sleep. There is a marked change in consciousness. There is a shift in reality. And sometimes people will literally feel a physical shift in reality, like there's some sort of curtain that's pulled back, or there's a bleed through another reality that the physical world fades or it changes somehow. There's time displacement and time distortion, and sometimes the experiences are very real, like they engage all the senses in a very realistic way, and sometimes they take place more from a clairvoyant perspective. It's still real, but it's the perception of it is with the clairvoyant faculty and more on the mental screen than with the physical eyes. So it's a combination of all of these things, and many of them do take place in the dream state, which I think happens for a specific reason. And this even goes back to the wisdom of the ancients, that dreams are a bridge between our reality and these other realities. And Plato called it the between state. This was where human beings could go and meet the dead and the gods, in ways that they could not during waking consciousness. And we are outside of time and space when we sleep and dream. And I think other entities who want to engage with us, they know this. And they know how to interact with our dreaming state in order to have certain kinds of interactions and engagements with us.
Right. I think what your research is showing, the research of so many other people, is that we have to expand our definition of the human being, of who we are and what we're capable of, and also our understanding of the ultimate reality. because it needs to include these other realms that have been blocked out and limited by the Western scientific paradigm. And, you know, most people, most cultures haven't had that limit, so they've had these acknowledgments of these experiences. So do you see that coming? Do you see a shift in science possibly where we can expand our paradigm?
It's inevitable. And I think it's an inevitable outcome just based even solely on global consciousness. Because we are so united now internationally in an instant, we can react en masse to things. And even things like people reporting their experiences and portrayals of that in the media have the capability of engaging substantial portions of the human population at any given time. And so inevitably, this is going to shift our reality. The challenge for us is going to be, how are we going to manage this shift? It will either seriously challenge some people who will want to hold on to old paradigms that don't work anymore. There will be people who will want to manipulate that consciousness and maybe even work with other entities who want to manipulate human consciousness. And then there will be people who will want to use this, literally this power and this force, for the betterment of the planet and humanity and the other life forms that we share this planet with. So there could be a lot of conflict involved in this emergence of a new reality. Therefore, it's very important for us to be aware of what's going on.
Well, there already is. I mean, it seems to me a lot of conflict that this reality is unfolding and that there's more of a seamless web. I just read an article about animal slaughters help produce earthquakes because of the energy of these animals. Have you seen that article? And there was this thing that was planned in Nepal to kill these thousands and thousands of animals, and then they had this earthquake there. There's bleed-throughs to all these realities, and I think the lines between them are becoming much thinner, and that there's one more thing, though, that's also happening is an increased vibrational frequency that seems to be going on for matter itself, earth-based matter that seems to be elevating or awakening people to these other realms. So I think we're getting huge bleed-throughs of these other realities that are changing people's concepts and perceptions. Do you agree with that?
We certainly are. And one of the unknowns is, how fast is this going to progress? Because if it progresses too fast, then there's the potential for, social breakdown. And if it happens at a reasonable pace where more and more people can assimilate these changes and contribute to them in positive ways, then these openings will occur at a rate that we can accommodate. If for example, we had something, everyone wanted, for example, in ufology, there's always a clamor for disclosure. Let's have disclosure. Right. And we're in the midst of disclosure with all of our experiences. That's living daily disclosure is going on all the time.
And you think these 2,000 people that are going to be showing up in Joshua Tree at the end of May, that's a part of disclosure? Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of that. What's showing up?
The 2,000 people or so, 1,500, 2,000 people that will be showing up in Joshua Tree at the end of May to talk about all this, that's part of disclosure, you're saying?
Well, all of these events are part of disclosure, but you know, there's this constant clamor for official disclosure, for governments to come forward and, you know, lay down the proof that aliens are real, show us something real that we can't deny. And there are all these deadlines that are predicted. It's going to happen by such and such a date, and it never does. And we may never get that kind of disclosure because we're in disclosure now with people participating in shifts of reality. But let's just say that we had some sort of massive event where globally we had to confront a living being from another reality, and there would be no way to deny this. And there would be no, like, vague photographs, no reports, no disappearing craft, evidence, you know, that sort of thing. It would be irrefutable. And that has the potential to set off all kinds of unpredictable reactions among people. And I think the same thing could happen with proof of the afterlife, like I was talking about a little bit ago. Anytime that you have irrefutable proof of something that threatens existing structures like religion and social structure and even political structure, then the powers that be are going to worry about, how to keep a handle on it. And are you going to have a culturalization from that, which even the early SETI pioneers speculated on that if we got some sort of irrefutable proof of any kind of other intelligence, that the ramifications and consequences could be very unpredictable.
Well, it's about,
but we're headed in that direction anyway.
Yes, it's going to happen. And I think all the sightings that are going on, and they appear, you know, and maybe hundreds or thousands of people see, and then they're gone. And there's a slow ongoing disclosure that I think, you know, maybe it'll take 100 years or 200 or 20 years for it to be not such a big deal. But it's coming. I do think it's coming. And I think this also will include this whole idea of perception and the paranormal, which, you know, in a sense is really not paranormal. It's just another level of human awareness. Don't you think so?
Oh, very, very true. Yes. The whole term paranormal is likely to become obsolete because all that stuff is around us all the time anyway. And people have experiences that many of them will shake them off, deny them. It's just their imagination, or they'll have some other explanation for it. What I find when I talk about a lot of kinds of experiences that have patterns to them that large numbers of people have, like shadow people, for example, or even angels, or almost anything you can name, I will always, and I'm not alone in this, other researchers experience the same. I will always hear from people say, oh my gosh, the same thing happened to me. I didn't know this was a real thing, that other people were having this kind of experience too.
I know, and it does seem like, but have you done any neurological testing to see, because I think the perception of these realities have to do with accessing different portions of our brain, is just why we're in different states of consciousness. So are there any researchers working in that field of paranormal neurology? I mean, I know a near-death experience is a little bit of that, but what have you found?
Well, in fact, there are scientists working in this area to see what we're hardwired to experience.
Yes.
And that we are literally hardwired to experience things like God and alternate realities. And so there are scientists who say, well, you know, these are just brain functions, and so that doesn't mean that these other realities exist. It's all in the brain. But the new take on that is that, no, we can experience these other realities because we have the raw material in our brain, and in our consciousness to do so.
Right.
So I think we need to flip that one around.
Yes, they got it totally backwards, you know. If you can experience, if you can sense it through our neurology, then there's a reality that could exist. Absolutely.
So there are emerging new fields in neuroscience to examine these things. But even so, these efforts are still on the fringe of hard science. It wasn't very many years ago I went to an international conference had a lot of neuroscientists in it. It was billed as a conference on consciousness, but it was more about neuroscience. And almost all of those scientists that I spoke to at that conference, who are from all over the world, dismissed all of this stuff as fantasy and even hallucination, or, you know, the product of a deranged mind. You know, if there was something wrong with you, if you had these experiences.
Oh, that's too bad. Because, you know, there's Dean, people like Dean Radin and Rupert Sheldrake. There are scientists, and Gary Schwartz. There are some scientists on our side that are interested in looking at the phenomena.
Well, fortunately, yes. And, you know, many of those people in the field will acknowledge that to try and pursue these areas openly and professionally, it can be a career killer for a lot of them. And so we don't have the funding sources. We don't have the academic tracks. We don't have, you know, very many ways for these individuals to pursue these lines of research. But I think that's changing. And whether or not that can change fast enough to keep pace with the experiences that people are having anyway. No matter what these scientists think and say, people are having these experiences on an increasing frequency. And that alone is going to profoundly change things.
Well, look at Eben Alexander, you know, a neurosurgeon who had this amazing near-death experience, and now he says, you know, absolutely, this is real. He would never have thought it before. I mean, have you talked to him about that work he's involved in?
I did have the opportunity to meet him a couple of years ago at the International Association for Near-Death Studies. In fact, I was giving a talk at the same conference on dream visits from the dead, and that these are real experiences that we have while we're in the dream state, and these bridges form. And I'm always glad to see people like Dr. Alexander come along, and Raymond Moody, many others in the field. Dean Radin has done some wonderful work. I'm a big fan of Rupert Sheldrake. Yeah. We've had many scientists who, and medical people who have come forward and said, you know, we really need to change the way we think about things. Larry Dossey, Bernie Siegel, you know, many, many names in the field. And yet the institution itself is still very slow to change.
Right. But anyway, we're talking to an audience, but I mean, of course, but let's just, because you know what I love about your research is that you really look into everything. Could we just lay out the landscape from, I mean, I know it's vast, but from what you know, like who's out there in these multidimensional worlds, the djinns and the fairies? I mean, tell me, could you lay some of that out and tell me where you see it, or maybe even what level of vibration these things are, from ghosts to fairies to angels and all that in between?
Yes, I can provide an overview.
Yes.
And I've changed a lot of my views on ghosts over the years. I think that what we call ghosts tend to be non-intelligent residual energy. And,
oh, you don't think they're dead people that have been stuck, like, you know?
Well, there are people who do get stuck, but I think that most haunting phenomena is just residual. And when places are haunted with presences that seek interaction with people and they especially act out against people, even if they have a human-like appearance from time to time, or they identify themselves as dead people, you're probably dealing with masquerading spirits. I think
masquerading spirits that were not they weren't incarnated. You're saying.
I'm sorry, Alan.
Masquerading spirits. I'm not sure what you mean by that. They weren't people that had lived.
No, they're entities who assume the personalities of dead people. I think that this happens in cases where you have poltergeist phenomena. People have disturbances that are unpleasant, that don't go away, even if the personality has identified itself as, some deceased, or shows up in, some period clothing or whatever. It's well known in occultism that spirits are capable of masquerading as people and the dead. And so I think that most haunting phenomena, not all, but most haunting phenomena is simply residual. It's leftover energy that the human dead have left behind in psychic space. Mm-hmm. And eventually this residual energy will run out of steam. It's not on an eternal battery. And mm-hmm. this is why some very old and famous hauntings don't seem to happen much anymore, because they just ran out of juice.
Right.
And that's going to happen to all residual energy at some point. Now, about 10 years ago, I started studying, a little over 10 years ago, I started studying shadow people. And that led me to the djinn, who I was already familiar with through studying the magical literature and cross religious literature. I began to see their presence in a more pervasive way throughout all of our extraordinary experiences. And I believe that they participate in everything from hauntings to what we would call ET encounters and abductions. They were present among ancient aliens and gods. They have a very strong connection to fairies. And in fact, there are so many similarities between fairies and djinn, it's very hard to say where one leaves off and the other starts.
Well, what is a djinn, though? How are they? Are they semi-physical? How do they show up?
They have no known form, but they shapeshift. And according to the lore about them, they were here on the planet before us and lost out to us. There are different stories about that. We find the same thing with fairies. Mm-hmm. And they can appear in solid form. They can appear as apparitions. They can be monstrous. They can be beautiful. They can be hybrid creatures, half human, half animal, or combinations of different animals. And when I began applying their characteristics and behavior patterns to anomalies across the board, whether it was abducting ETs or the Space Brothers or fairies or demons or ghosts, mysterious creatures and cryptids, one can see the djinn presence everywhere. And I do not think, at this stage in my research, I do not think that the djinn account for everything, although I have met researchers who do. And I certainly see their presence in all of our experiences.
So how do they show up?
What are their motives? Why
good.
Are they salting themselves in a hidden way in all of these experiences? There may not be a single motive. The djinn are probably as varied as human beings, and we would not categorize everybody around the globe as a terrorist or as a charity worker or that we're all good, all bad.
There are good djinns then, right?
Yes, there are. And they have different motives for dealing with us, just like human beings have no unified purpose in doing anything on the planet. We have multiple purposes going on all the time, multiple agendas. And I think that's the same with them, too.
You know,
there
I think
may be
Carlos
some who...
Yeah. I was just saying, I think Carlos Castaneda called them the inorganic beings, but, you know, that's just another name for what you're saying. But,
well, there
yeah, go ahead.
Well, there are probably many names for them. I think they've gone by many labels throughout history and from culture to culture. So the djinn are still a very important part of my research because I consider them to be a very important part of this new reality, that if they are accounting for so many ways of interacting with people, then they have a significant interest in being in this reality and in dealing with us. And some of those motives are unfriendly. Some of them are manipulative. Some of them are helpful to a point. But it seems that the djinn who are of a more enlightened mind aren't real interested in us. We're kind of a lower life form to them. So we're dealing more with the hostile end of the spectrum.
Do they have, can they help us with each other? Do they have emotion in the way that we have? Or are they unemotional?
Well, they certainly express emotion, and they have, according to their own accounts and lore, they have families and structures, a society. They certainly express feelings toward people. Some of them become absolutely enamored with people and want to pursue romantic relationships. Others are hostile and want to take the life force. They want to be very destructive toward people, so that would be a rather hateful emotion.
Is that the incubus and the succubus? Were they part of that djinn lore, you think?
We could certainly account for that kind of sexual encounter with djinn. Yes, they are capable of doing that. Now, do they account for all of that, or are there, you know, like demons as well? Are all demons djinn? These get into some very gray areas. And, in fact, all of these realities out there that we're encountering, it's a blurry landscape. And part of it may be the level of the very primitive level of our perception of these realities. There's a lot of murkiness. And if you look at the documentation of people's experiences and along with collections of folklore and things like that over the ages in any particular area, whether it's angels or vampires or demons, fairies, even the djinn, you find conflicting material where descriptions of the entities could be labeled one thing in one culture and one thing in another culture, and yet the characteristics and the behavior are the same. So this emerging reality that we're heading toward, I think we'll find clarification and probably some unification in these viewpoints, because I don't think we're dealing with scads of different entities. I think we're dealing with a much smaller pool.
Right, I think so. Have you ever met Lorna Byrne, who claims to see angels everywhere? Do you know her work?
I've never met her, but I am familiar with it, yes.
Oh, I think you'd really find her fascinating. She sees a really higher level to these angelic beings are really here to help us and, you know, uplift the planet, too. But
I believe that we are having many encounters with angels and that angels are distinctly different from djinn and from us, and they are bringing a higher vibration into consciousness, and it's very important for us to connect with that.
I mean, it really does come down to expanding who we are as a human being. I feel like to acknowledge the innate perceptions that can be developed and, you know, worked on so the landscape doesn't have to be as murky as it is. I think that's also what will be coming to us as a civilization.
I mean, well, I certainly would like to see that unfold. When you look at, you know, how we've viewed these things throughout history, sometimes it seems to us now, and it does to many people, that the ancients were wiser than we are in this regard. And I think in some ways they were, and in some ways not. But we seem to go through cycles and also around in circles a lot. And yet there is an evolutionary spiral to it. The thing is, now we have high technology, which can take us at a very rapid pace, even an exponential change rate. And we don't have hundreds, if not thousands, of years to gradually adapt or assimilate concepts and ideas and even experiences. The rate of change is incredibly speeded up, and that's literally being forced on us. So that's where we're really challenged to evolve ourselves in the right direction.
Right, and we are. I mean, but before we go there, I wanted to ask you about the ancients who were aware. I mean, there were some great beings that were aware of how to control these djinns or beings like that, people like John Dee and some of the old Kabbalists, the old Jewish alchemists. Those, there were, you know, the golems and... So what do you have to say about those humans who are magicians or sorcerers who could act with these djinns and manipulate them to do things in this world?
Well, we still have people like that today who have those abilities, and I would say you know, a good number of them are rather quiet about it, especially in our culture. In other cultures, they work a little more openly. But... here again, there are just many different motives. One of my websites is called djinnuniverse.com, and that's djinnuniverse.com. I highly recommend it to people. It's a real eye-opener because people from all over the world have contributed their knowledge and experiences to provide some very interesting views on what these beings are like. And, for example, in other parts of the world, it's accepted and understood and quite well known that people who are interested in acquiring power of any kind, whether it's political power or economic power or even power in a romantic sort of way, might resort to asking for help from the djinn, and they would go to a certain kind of sorcerer for that. Who has the ability to contact the djinn and to ask for those services. But it's not a one-way street. It's an exchange. There's always, of course, a payment for that. And sometimes the payment is allowing the djinn to have access to the individual and to their family for manipulation or... you know, the djinn can ask people to do things as well. Some of them are interested in taking of the life force. It's an energy that they can use for themselves, and they can draw that off people in a variety of ways. And
like we
don't have that those kinds of acknowledgments in our culture, and yet throughout history, people have engaged the spirit world for help in all kinds of situations for crushing enemies and getting love and getting money and whatever. So, you know, nothing has changed. People are still doing that.
Well, it's like selling your soul to the devil, I guess, was sort of came out of that, didn't it?
Well, it's a version of that, yes, that when you make a deal, it's a rather serious thing.
But
so,
I do like...
People, now I have heard reports from people who say that they have had djinn help them, and they think they have an entirely different view of djinn, that they've had help in, you know, getting on in life or getting a job or getting better health or whatever. But the problem is that a lot of times these relationships eventually go south, and that the entity will start off helping an individual, and then you know, they'll start turning, and that's a very predictable pattern too. So I usually tell people, well, I don't usually, I always tell people, it's not a good idea to go summoning, especially the jinn, or any kind of entity, to ask for favors. I mean, even the angels are not capable of pulling our chestnuts out of the fire. Angels are able to give us spiritual support and strength and guidance through an improved contact with the divine. And they're conduits, they're messengers, they're pipelines. But it's not their job to do things for us that we need to learn how to do ourselves.
Well, yeah, it's amazing how complex the unseen landscape really is. I mean, this place, this earth plane, is sort of the simplest of all. What you see is what you get here, right? And there's all these other realms that are so vast and full of potential in some ways.
And they're right next to us, Alan, you know. We have experiences all the time where we get the bleed through from this reality to another. It's they're just vibrating at different rates that are beyond our usual perceptions, and they're right here. They're connected to Earth, and they've shared a destiny on this planet with us. And then we do have off-world visitors. I'm convinced of that too. But the bulk of our experiences are just right here on Earth.
Well, and some people would even say we actually live in those other realms too. We're just not aware of it, you know. So we're always interacting in that ways, in those ways, you know.
I think we have many interactions that we wouldn't ordinarily attribute to the spirit world, but there is some sort of involvement with the spirit world. And a lot of it goes down to those experiences that people just kind of shrug off as, oh, well, that was weird, or must have been my imagination, you know, that sort of thing. There are entities, many kinds of entities, who are capable of having an influence on our thoughts and our moods. And people who have acquired certain spirit attachments, or they have very thin boundaries with the spirit world, might be more prone to those influences.
Well, especially people who've taken drugs or alcohol, there's definitely what I feel holes in those auric fields that let those beings come in easier. So, you know, we need to have good paranormal hygiene, I think, you know, as you might call it.
We certainly do, and abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, substance abuse, all of these things can make the aura, which is your natural defense against these sorts of things, it can make it weaker and even put holes and rips in them. Sometimes even when people go through severe emotional crises, it can make them more vulnerable. And I certainly saw that as a pattern, a documentable pattern in shadow people experiences, that there's a whole subset of shadow people that move in on a person when they're in emotional upheaval. And they're able to latch on to a person's energy field. And it seems that they thrive on that kind of chaotic energy. So, like people going through severe financial, marital, health crises, and experience, you know, severe depression or anger, or, you know, just feeling like, you know, everything's in chaos. They're worried. They're fearful. These are emotions that will attract certain predatory entities. And oftentimes then when the people get their lives back in balance, the entities go away because the energy isn't there for them anymore.
But also, it makes it a little harder for those people to get it back in balance because those entities are weighing in down those people as well, you know?
A lot of it depends on how much influence the entity is able to exert. And I have cases that, you know, run the gamut from temporary to extremes, and even chronic ones that long after a person has passed the crisis, they seem to have some sort of low-grade ongoing interference from an attachment perspective. Mm-hmm. So it raises some interesting questions about how much are we influenced by beings that we normally don't perceive.
But of course, Jungian psychologists would say there are aspects of ourself, of our own thought form projections, but you would disagree, I suppose.
I lean toward the interaction with the spirit world. And I've studied a lot of Jungian psychology, and I think that Jung was able to address a lot of these things in a very profound way, and he was certainly a man of experiences himself, especially from the dream perspective.
Right.
Here again, it's like, well, where do we draw the line where one leaves off and the other starts? And it may not be, in many cases, it may not be one or the other, but a combination of things.
Well,
one
that's
thing
true.
I found in studying all of these areas is that there's no nice little pie chart, you know, to divide things. We get back into these blurry areas.
We're still uncovering these realities. So at Contact in the Desert, what are you going to be speaking about there?
I'm going to be talking about the jinn influence in ancient aliens and gods on into ET abductions, and how I've documented their presence, and my own theories as to what's going on and what they're up to. I'm constantly learning new things in my research. I've done two books on the jinn to date. I'm putting together a third, which will probably be out early next year sometime. And the overlaps of people's experiences with entities that are clearly jinn in behavior and description, along with ET and UFO elements, it's quite an interesting picture. And it's also actually been inadvertently documented in abduction literature for decades. It's just that people haven't recognized the presence.
In what way has it been documented in abduction? Because I'm studying that. How?
Well, for example, I came to the conclusion several years ago that shadow people are a form taken by jinn. That was the only explanation that fit the behavior and characteristics of so many constellations of patterns of shadow people. And I still feel that shadow people are jinn.
Right.
And shadow people are present in abduction experiences. Not all of them, but they have a significant...
How are they present? Are people just not able to cognize the ETs and calling them shadow? Or how do you see the shadow people present in the abductions?
Shadow people will precede abductions and follow abductions. And,
shadow people experiences.
Then we also have to allow for the possibility of some of these abducting entities to be jinn as well. But many abductees will have histories of shadow people encounters and also shadow people encounters just prior to abductions and in the periods following abductions. So what are they doing? Are they paving the way? Are they opening doors? Are they monitoring things? Are they working with entities, against other entities? Are they spying? There are many different possibilities at work. And also, given that one of the favorite forms of the jinn is reptilian, then we have to re-examine the whole reptilian element of ET abductions and encounters from a jinn perspective as well.
Well, couldn't the abductions and the shadow people have to do with a sort of thought invasion, in a sense that the ETs start to prepare the abductee for this traumatic event, and they kind of move into their field to sort of pull them in at some point, you know, as it happens, there's a premonition of sorts to the abduction that may be a mistake as shadow people, but it might just be a different form of ET pre-contact.
They might be harbingers. One of the things that shadow people do a lot is they observe people. And occasionally, I shouldn't say occasionally, because it does happen frequently, shadow people will attack people. That seems to be a different scenario. But shadow people will often stand and watch. They observe. People will report that they feel like these entities are trying to get inside their heads and their bodies, that they seem to watch them a lot, track them. They look in on them. And so, are they reconnaissance? Are they identifying people that are prime targets for abduction activities? Are they opening up interdimensional doorways when they show up? There could be any number of purposes going on there, and it may not be just one purpose. It could be a combination of things and a combination of different purposes in any given case.
Well, can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
No, do you ever get scared? And how do you protect yourself? Well, do you get scared? I mean, it is scary. I mean, this is what horror movies are made of. I mean, how do you protect yourself?
Well, the best protection is a daily practice of meditation and having just your own good spiritual foundation. And I've been meditating for most of my adult life, and I've had teachers comment on how much that's changed my energy field. And I think you need a very good buffer around you if you're going to deal with the spirit world in any regard. I mean, you can start out wanting to talk to angels, but if you open yourself up to the spirit realms, there's a lot of other things out there besides angels, and you're not necessarily going to be able to cherry pick exactly what you encounter. So it's good to have a good buffer.
But
and,
did you ever?
I have also developed a lot of contact with the angel realm, and I consider them to be one of the most powerful lines of defense against anything from the dark side. But yes, some of it's very disturbing, and when I say disturbing, I mean the implications of what might be going on in many areas of human life in a negative way. It's disturbing, and these entities can be quite formidable and scary. I take them very seriously. And I have a great deal of respect for them. There have been times when I have pulled back or, made what I call a prudent exit because things were getting out of hand. And entities who can see you and you can't always see them can often upset the balance of power very quickly, if they are determined to do so. It takes an awful lot of energy too. So I didn't go looking for this, Alan. You know, these things just sort of came and found me. And I feel that it's important to pursue these lines of research. And so I keep at it.
Well, it's so important because you're giving us a wider view of what's true, what's real, what's true, what's really happening, and science could deny that because they like to put everything into a small little box, but you're giving us a greater truth, and it's the same thing with the disclosure. We need to know the truth because, you know, the greater view of reality you have, the more expanded we are in some ways. So anyway, thank you, Rosemary.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Alan, and I get a very good response to the lines of research that I've undertaken with the gin. I get a lot of corroboration, and I get it from people of all religions. It's, you know, not just, this is not a religious thing, and we can't look at gin, especially as a Muslim thing, because so much of the lore comes out of the Middle East. The jinn are everywhere, and the jinn have free will to practice whatever religion they want. They may even have their own religions that we're unaware of, but they can certainly adopt any of ours, and they do.
I mean, they may be the trolls or of the northern countries or the elves or the, right? I mean, they show up in many different ways.
They certainly could be. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, I've encountered researchers who feel that the jinn are really the source of all of our experiences except for angels, that it's us angels and the jinn. And the jinn just keep shape-shifting to different forms as a way to either amuse themselves or distract us and confuse us or cater to our ever-changing viewpoints. And we're in a technological age now, and so they're taking, you know, these ET forms and playing around with us in that way.
I don't necessarily agree with that myself, but I think there are ETs, and there might be djinns, and there might be a whole slew of undefined beings. You know, I do like what you're saying about technology and uplifting our consciousness and opening the veils between these dimensions. So can you just restate that, what you're saying?
My own personal view is that we are dealing with many different kinds of entities, and that the jinn are among them. I think that they're one of the more important entities that we're dealing with because of their ability to sort of shape-shift and hide in a lot of ways, and that they seem to have a pervasive presence and intense interest. I do think that we're dealing with beings from off-world, ETs, and that not all of the otherworldly beings we encounter are jinn. I think that would, to me, that's actually a very limited reality rather than an expanded reality if it's just three of us, you know, humans, angels, and jinn. One of the things that we don't have the ability to do at present is to make these distinctions. We know in our culture especially, we know so little about any of them, especially the jinn, that how would we know how to separate one from the other? And we lack the spiritual perception to do so because we can't perceive these other realities consistently in a clearly way and in a consensual way.
Do you think we could build a technology that could detect them? Because if they exist, they're a frequency, and frequencies can be detected.
If we have the ability to develop subtle energy devices, then I think we would start getting a clearer focus on these. And there are researchers who are pursuing those avenues. I just don't think we've gotten any significant developments in the field yet. But that's one of the areas that would have a great deal of promise.
Well, thank you, Rosemary, for being a guest. What's your website?
My main website is visionaryliving.com, and that has my schedule of events, sign up for my free monthly newsletter, library of articles, and upcoming things. And then jinnuniverse.com, D-J-I-N-N universe, is devoted solely to discussions about the jinn.
Well, thank you, and I'll see you at Contact in the Desert.
I'm looking forward to it, Alan. It's going to be a great event. I'm quite excited about it.
Have you been out to Joshua Tree before?
I have, yes. And I've been to the Integratron and Giant Rock. I have not been to the other two Contact in the Desert conferences, so this the conference itself will be my first. But Joshua Tree is, it's understandable why it's such a hot zone. It is one of those interface areas.
Yeah, and you'll have a great time at the conference. It's a lot of fun, lots of people, lots of curious people, lots of very, very open people. I would say this one conference that I've been to, that the people really come willing to share their experiences and be open to all sorts of possibilities. So it's really great that way. Anyway, thanks. I was emceeing the last 2 years. I'll be there this year. So I'll look forward to seeing you then.
Well, same here, Alan. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your time. And we'll do an interview in New York at some point, too. Okay?
Excellent.
Okay. See you soon.
Bye. Good night.
Good night. That was Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who, as you've been hearing, is a real expert in paranormal metaphysics, other realms, interdimensionality, all sorts of beings that inhabit all sorts of places, and the understanding of our human interaction with those realms. So thanks for listening tonight. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and you can find me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.